supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. A Pennsylvania lawmaker is pushing back against so-called sanctuary campuses. Colleges and universities refusing to cooperate with federal immigration authorities to protect undocumented students. WHYY's Katie Colinari reports.
State Representative Jerry Knowles, a Republican, is planning to introduce a bill that would cut off state funding to those sanctuary campuses.
This is not at all to punish the kids, any of the kids. This is to tell presidents and administrators of any university that gets money from the Commonwealth that they need to understand that I believe that they have an obligation to comply with federal law.
The state has just two sanctuary campuses, the University of Pennsylvania and Swarthmore College, which are both private. But Knowles' bill could put at risk millions of state dollars for UPenn's veterinary school. Federal officials rarely carry out immigration law enforcement at colleges and universities. Still, the sanctuary campus movement has grown out of fear that President-elect Donald Trump will end a program allowing young people brought into the country illegally as children to study and work in the U.S. temporarily. The program has benefited more than 5,000 undocumented students in Pennsylvania. Knowles would not say whether he thinks it should stay or go under the Trump administration.
Illegal is illegal. How they deal with those kids again, I'm sure they're going to do it in a fair manner. I think that you have a liberal faction that are deliberately doing what they're doing to stir things up and to aggravate and agitate people.
Knowles plans to introduce the bill in the next legislative session and claims he has more than two dozen co-sponsors, including some Democrats. Katie Colinari, WHYY News.
During this season of giving, let's go next to a school in North Philadelphia. Richard Wright Elementary sits in one of the city's poorest neighborhoods, and for the last few years, it's received an outflow of support from volunteers who live in some of the region's wealthiest zip codes. WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Aaron brings us this story of charity, inequality, and the effort to build an unlikely community.
Our story starts with a note. I spotted it while wandering through the library at Richard Wright, a K-5 school in Philly's Strawberry Mansion section. And immediately, this note stood out.
Dear Suburban Moms, thank you for cleaning up the library. Thank you for buying us new books and putting them on the shelves. We are happy, joyful, and grateful. Our hearts feel loved.
It was signed by Room 221 with the names of about 25 kindergartners scrawled underneath in magic marker, and it was a lovely little token of gratitude. But what struck me was the intro. Dear Suburban Moms, something about that label felt off, maybe a little uncomfortable. I mean, who parachutes into a low-income urban community and calls themselves the Suburban Moms? And that question led me to a stay-at-home mom from Chester County named Bonnie Koss. About 4 years ago, Koss started organizing little get-togethers with moms in her wealthy Philadelphia suburb. In late 2013, they decided that for one of these get-togethers, everyone should donate school supplies to a low-income school in Philadelphia. So Koss called up the school district and said, point me to your neediest school. I got a whole bunch of school supplies to unload. The district pointed her to Richard Wright.
So when we unloaded our cars and brought them into the front office, they had asked me if I wanted a tour of the school.
The tour eventually brought them to a large room lined with bookshelves, and it had exactly one book in it.
And they said, this is our library. And it was like, how can this be your library?
There are 220 traditional public schools in Philadelphia and 6 school librarians. The near total absence of school libraries is just one of the stark differences between Philly schools and those in the wealthier suburbs. But for Koss, this image seemed to crystallize the imbalance.
I don't know what the switch was other than once I saw it, I couldn't unsee it.
Koss and her friends started collecting used children's books by the thousands, but they soon realized that the staff of the school didn't have time to put them on the shelves. So Koss and company started to shelve the books, which brought them into the school every day. And then they decided to put on a spring fair for the students, and then they decided to adopt a second elementary school nearby.
We really just ended up replicating almost everything that we do in the suburbs.
Teacher luncheons, class trips, extra classroom supplies. When Richard Wright needed something, Koss and her friends would throw up an alert, and the resources would roll in. On a recent Wednesday, the suburbanites pull up with platters of cookies and individually wrapped books. The cookies are for the teachers, the gifts go to the kids. It seems like a nice little gesture, but Principal Janine Payne says it's a lot more than that.
It manifests as little things, but these are the things that differentiate charter schools, suburban public schools, this expectation of parent involvement.
Payne says one of the crucial differences between the haves and the have-nots are these often nebulous networks of supporters that schools can lean on to fill gaps.
I don't think we'll ever be able to replace suburban moms, but I believe the core of being able to provide service, being able to, you know, support the school or the students, that idea can take root.
Bonnie Koss sees things much the same way. Her goal for this school year is to forge a partnership with the parents in the community, parents she's had almost no connection with so far. Meanwhile, she's hosted forums in the suburbs on racial injustice and tried to think more deeply about what it means to be a group of wealthy white volunteers in a school that is overwhelmingly black and poor.
But I also was aware of this white knight approach, and I was concerned of how we were being received, and I wanted to make sure that we were doing things in a way that was truly a partnership.
Earlier this year, she attended Back to School Night and sent out emails to recruit parents for the group, but so far it hasn't taken. Part of the reason may be that darn name, Suburban Moms. As I found out, Bonnie Koss and her friends never called themselves the Suburban Moms. It's a name that started, innocently enough, among teachers and stuck.
It just makes us sound like it's just suburban that we're a group of just suburban moms, and I want us to truly be a partnership of parents.
These suburban moms were trying to do work that mattered, and yet that name, Suburban Moms, also spoke to the difficulties of doing that work. They were still outsiders in the city, and those from the community who had interacted with them already had to overcome their own skepticism. Gladys Woodbury is a longtime volunteer at Richard Wright, part of a core group who've maintained a parent presence in the absence of a formal parent organization. When she first saw the suburban moms, she assumed they'd come and go.
I was like, okay, they just came to do something, all right. And then every time I look up, here they are. So it's not to just do something. They got something to do.
Woodbury says there's a difference.
When you're just doing something, you want to be seen. When you got something to do, you're doing it till it's done.
So when will the suburban moms be done? Perhaps when people here in North Philadelphia don't call them the suburban moms anymore. I'm Avi Wolf-Manera, WHYY News.
'Tis the night before Christmas. Let's summon the season with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Well, Frank, to start, what percentage of the population today identifies with a Christian religion?
It is about 74%, three-quarters of Americans, which may sound low, but when you look at the percent who don't identify with any religion, those are the nuns we've talked about before. Doesn't mean they're not religious, mind you, but when we call up and say, what religion are you? They say they don't have a formal religion. That's 21%. So do the math. That leaves only about 5% of Americans who identify with a religion, but it is a non-Christian religion.
It's also the advent of Hanukkah, and of that remaining 5%, are most of them Jewish?
They are not. About 2% is Jewish of that 5%, and about 0.8, to be specific, are Muslims, identify with the Islamic religion. So that leaves a little over 3% who are other non-Christian religion. We probe them and say, is this a Christian religion or not? And they say no.
Back to that nuns category, to what extent has that grown over the time that Gallup's been polling on this?
Well, it has certainly grown, and in fact is one of the most significant changes in American religion that we and other scholars look at. When we started asking about religion in the late 1940s, 48, 49, and into the 1950s, we had 2%, 3% of Americans who didn't have a religious identity. But going into the 70s and the 80s, the percent who were nuns started to go up. It crossed the 10% barrier. Then it's really been over the last 5 or 10 years that we've seen it increase through 15%. And now, as we just talked about this year, 21% of Americans, when we call them up, don't have a formal religious identification.
Frank, this is also the season when Gallup polls on Americans' attitudes around honesty and ethics of professions. Remind us what the parameters of the questions are.
Well, it's a very interesting question we've been asking for quite a long time, and it's very simple. It says, tell me how you would rate the honesty and ethical standards of people in different fields. And then we read them a list of professions, and we basically look at the percent who say very high or high in terms of perceived honesty and ethics.
Politicians obviously won. What's two?
Well, our elected representatives wish that were the case. We'll come back to that. But at the top of the list are healthcare professionals, which is quite interesting because there's a lot of controversy about healthcare. Pharmaceuticals costing too much, cost and access to health care, the most urgent health care problems facing this country we find in our data. And yet the professionals, the men and women who actually deliver the health care, have very, very positive images. And I should say, nurses, if you're listening, congratulations once again. You are head and shoulders above everybody else in terms of perceived honesty and ethics. An 84% honesty rating for nurses. Following nurses are pharmacists, medical doctors, engineers, the only one out of the top five that's not a medical professional, and then dentists round out the top five.
I wonder if part of the key is that term you use, delivery, and that we interface directly one-on-one with somebody in that profession, and they in turn hopefully deliver a diagnosis and treatment, and that's why perhaps in part they're at the top.
I think that's right. And again, when we ask what's the most urgent health care problem facing the country, people say cost and access, that is getting to the medical professionals and then paying for it. And that's, I think, somewhat separate from the professionals themselves. Once you get in there, once you see the nurse, the doctor, the dentist, you get your pills from a pharmacist, Americans are very, very positive.
Who else is at or near the top?
Well, after those top five, police officers, and they actually took a dip back in 2014 with a lot of the controversy, but they're back up there at 58% positive ratings on honesty and ethics, and that's actually sixth out of the entire list. College teachers are up there, although down significantly. Clergy are up there, but they're down significantly as well. And then chiropractors, bankers, and journalists, but they're kind of in the middle of the list, way below those others that I mentioned.
Okay, Frank, now take us all the way down to the bottom.
Well, members of Congress, if you're listening, you have virtually no respect from the public, and only 8%, let me repeat that, only 8% of Americans say that members of Congress have very high or high honesty and ethical standards. Compare that again to nurses with an 84% honesty and ethical rating, and you see the huge gulf there. This is not new. Members of Congress have traditionally been low, but over the last several years, they've been as low as we've ever measured. They are, in fact, by 1 point lower than car salesmen with a 9% very high or high honesty and ethical rating. Car salesmen traditionally were at the bottom of the list, but members of Congress have now eclipsed them. Others near the bottom are insurance salesmen, advertising practitioners. That's an interesting phrase, but that's the one Dr. George Gallup started using many years ago. HMO managers, and then senators, also not as bad as members of Congress, but quite low.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. A Delaware judge got some help from Darth Vader during a special adoption ceremony this afternoon. WHYY's Mark Eichmann explains.
A short time ago, in a courthouse not too far away, 4-year-old Zoe was officially adopted by Deanna Petticone. In preparation for the big day, Deanna asked Zoe who she wanted to come to the ceremony.
And she said Darth Vader. So Darth Vader is her favorite character.
So after a call to Garrison Corita, an all-volunteer group of Star Wars Imperial costumers, Darth Vader showed up with some friends to help family court judge Barbara Kroll make the adoption official.
When Deanna came to me with the idea, I thought, oh, that would be great. And didn't know it was going to quite turn into what we did today, but
the special guests got big cheers, not something typically heard in the courthouse. Judge Kroll got in on the act as well, swapping her black judge's robe for a Princess Leia costume, complete with hair buns over her ears. And after a star-studded adoption ceremony, Zoe is officially Petticone's daughter.
It's like a weight that I didn't know I'd been carrying is now gone. Just to know that, as I told her today, forever starts today. And it's forever now, and I don't have to worry ever again.
Delaware's family court typically handles about 200 adoptions every year. None have been like this one. From the Delaware Desk, I'm Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
Drawn by thee, We're listening to a selection, Yaesu Joy of Man's Desiring, from A Bobby Hill Christmas, My Best for Him. And joining me now in studio, Bobby Hill. Bobby, thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you so much.
And that right there was truly the voice of an angel. Don't take my word for it. Director and actor Mark Wahlberg uttered that upon hearing you perform for the Pope.
Yeah, it was a great experience. When I finished singing for the Pope, he called me back over, and then there was an exchange, and then he went back over to the podium and said that, and that's where the voice of an angel originated from.
Well, let's back up a little bit. A Philadelphia native.
Yes.
15 years young. When did you first start singing?
My parents put me in my church choir at 3 years old.
And is that the Keystone State Boy Choir?
No, I joined the Keystone State Boy Choir at 7 years old. I've been in there ever since, and that's coming up on 8 years.
And what level of training and ongoing work gets you to the point where you, among other things, perform for the Pope?
Well, I had just been training with the choir, and I was practicing the song Pia Jesu, and they had me doing it at all the concerts. And then when it came time to go on stage and sing it, I was prepared to do it. So I guess I would call it courage, but when I had 5 minutes, I wasn't really that nervous. But afterwards, I was like, whoa, how did I do that? But in the moment, I kind of figured out how to turn my nervousness into excitement.
No stranger to the stage, you also performed here in Philadelphia at the opening of the Democratic National Convention. I assume that you're more typically performing for an audience whose age is 18 and over.
Definitely.
Having said that, to what extent do you feel it's important to inspire young children to get involved in similar endeavors and dreams?
I definitely feel that everybody has their own talent. And even if it's not singing, I feel like everybody should be exposed to the arts because it definitely opens your mind and it definitely creates more possibilities for you. The boy choir's choir director, me and him have been working on this charity called End Artslessness because there are only around 15 schools in the Philadelphia School District who are totally null and void of any music program. So we're trying to get people in there and raising money to get people in there to create after-school programs or during-school programs for just the small amount of schools that don't have music, and we call it Ending Artslessness.
So tell us about this CD. It's apparently hard to get right now.
Yeah, I debuted it on QVC. The orders and the advanced orders sold out in 2 hours, and now there's a growing wait list for the album.
What do you say we tease our listeners then? What's another track we can hear part of?
You can hear Adeste Fideles right now.
Do you recall the specific recording of that song? Like, how many takes does it take?
With the orchestra, I did like 4 or 5 takes.
4 or 5 takes. Was that one of the particularly challenging cuts, or that's about average?
No, that's about average. It's really hard to get a perfect take the first time. And even the second time or in the third time, if it's a perfect take, you always want other stuff to work with. So you do it as many times as you can or as necessary to be able to get a good quality project.
Let's give a listen. On one level, how can anything compare with a papal performance or performing at the Democratic National Convention? But if you park those high-profile events to the side, what are some memorable performance or performance halls that you've been to?
The mayor, Jim Kenney, he asked me to perform at the memorial for the victims of the Amtrak crash that happened here in Philadelphia. And I sang Amazing Grace, and it was just really fulfilling to know that your voice could bring someone some semblance of peace or help someone who's going through a rough time. And everybody was just thanking me and coming up to me, and people were crying, and it just felt so emotionally charged. And that's part of the reason, or one of the examples that I have, of that music affects more things than just the ear. It goes deeper than that.
Tell me about your affiliation with the trolley car diner on Germantown Avenue.
I'm friends with Ken Weinstein, who's the owner of both trolley car diner locations. when we saw that QVC sold out so quickly, we were like, we have to create somewhere for people to be able to get the album. So we were like, we went to Ken Weinstein and we asked if we could sell the albums in the trolley car diner. And he said, sure.
And if I in turn go to that diner and order the Bobby Hill, what's going to come to my table?
The album and a
burger. No, not the album. Not the album. What menu dish has he created in your name? What's on the burger?
Mushrooms, bacon, and Swiss.
Sounds great, but it doesn't exactly sound like a Christmas meal. Going out, what song would you like us to?
Oh Holy Night would be a great song to listen to. I like that one.
Bobby Hill Christmas, my best for him. Thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks
tonight. Thank you for having me.
Oh Holy Night, the stars are brightly shining.
That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. At the helm this week, Audrey Bentham, Diana Martinez, and Adam Staniszewski. Sandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. John Mussoni is Assistant Vice President for News Operations. Our News Director is Eugene Son. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us and have a great holiday weekend. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.